Hello and welcome back to the Full Cast and Crew podcast. It's my annual Oscar recap. As Vulture said in a very capable roundup, the highs were high, the lows very low, and the tonal whiplash constant. No, they weren't talking about Katie Britt's rebuttal to the State of the Union. They were talking about last night's Oscar telecast, which I'm here to talk about as well. So first off, I'm going to keep this quick and breezy. Let's talk about the telecast. First of all, Jimmy Kimmel is host. I thought Jimmy was okay. I thought he was a little off rhythm and timing wise. I thought he didn't really bring his A game. He had some good jokes. He also had some jokes that landed incredibly flat. And he capably kept things moving along. But there were other flaws in the telecast that I thought created awkwardness. For example, this structure where past acting award recipients would come on stage and do each an intro for one of the nominees. I found that so awkward. You know, there were some funny ones like Nick Cage talking about Paul Giamatti's use of a contact lens to create a wandering eye. Would I have done that? Hell yeah, but you did it first, buddy. That was great. But for every one of those, there were two or three more of a very wooden Jennifer Lawrence giving a pretty bland description of Lily Gladstone in Killers of the Flower Moon. So I understand what they're trying to do, but frankly, I would have rather seen well-chosen clips of the acting in question. To me, it felt a little bit like having the Grammy Awards, and instead of having musical performances, having other musicians describe what's great about this particular musical nominee and never playing the music. So I didn't get that. That didn't work for me. Please, for the love of God, all award shows, please, let's never do an in memoriam segment ever again on an awards telecast. Please. If you want to do that, make a great reel, spend some time and money on it, and put it out on social media whenever you want. Give the persons their due in a longer form piece of content that maybe people want to see. But my God, people, can we stop with the Andrea Bocelli? Oh my God. And whoever said, you know what in memoriam segments need? Interpretive dance. It's an embarrassment, people. And also, it never works. The online chatter about in memoriam segments is always negative, and not the way I'm being negative. It's negative in who wasn't there. Or they put all the names up in this screen and it's impossible to read for the viewer. Or there's a QR code. Are you kidding me? What are we, shopping for lettuce? Just stop doing it, okay? Not only would it save 20 minutes in an already bloated telecast, but it has no business really being in this. So I hated that. Oh, one other thing I forgot to mention. Can we possibly have people who win awards give their speeches in their native tongue? It's 2024. Everyone watches movies and television shows at home with the subtitles on, regardless of the language. And watching people last night try to express themselves in English only because they're on the Oscar telecast, it robbed them of an aspect of their moment that they may only have once in their life. And I'm thinking particularly of the filmmakers from Anatomy of a Fall, Justine Triet, and I'm thinking of the entire team that won for the Godzilla movie, who obviously were trying to express themselves in English. But it just occurred to me, you know, this telecast is on a delay anyway. We have the technology to do real-time subtitling. And I would rather have heard these people express themselves more fully and completely in their own language than to try and express themselves in English and kind of miss most of what they were trying to get across. So to me, if you really want to build this telecast as the supposed global ratings killer that it is, why are we still not allowing people to give acceptance speeches in their own language? It seems so backwards and so narrow-mindedly American. It annoyed me last night. And that's definitely a change they should make going forward. I thought that the presenters were okay, some of them. I thought the best presenters were definitely John Mulaney and Kate McKinnon. Those were funny. Those were well-written bits. I wish that all the bits could be that good. And I'm not sure why they can't be. For example, The Rock? Like, why is The Rock even still a thing? What was the last hit movie that The Rock did? And are you kidding me with this line after Bad Buddy speaks Spanish? The Rock says, "See? He's not such a bad bunny." Please. I hope that was an ad lib. I hope that wasn't written, because that kind of crap has no place being here. Al Pacino, I mean, look, give me an A or give me an F. So when Al Pacino came out and announced the best picture and didn't mention any of the nominees, and then just bizarrely, I thought he said something in French before he said Oppenheimer. I don't know what the hell happened. I mean, of course, I love that because it's a train wreck. So I'm all here for train wrecks. I thought the song performances, of course, the highlight of the whole telecast was Ryan Gosling doing Just Ken. I mean, that transcended the telecast. It's the only viral moment really to speak of. It's the only viral moment, period. Let's go out on a limb and say that. Nothing else will have legs. Nothing else reached the audience that way, both in the environment itself and on television and on social media. But as for the other song performances, can I just say, Billie Eilish, great talent, two-time Oscar winner at her age for her and her brothers, incredible. But I mean, this song is so overexposed at this point. How many times have you seen her perform that Barbie song on TV? I've personally seen it numerous times. And it's a great song, but it doesn't contain enough layers on repeat performances to bring us anything new. We've heard it and seen it all before too many times. So, you know, the telecast continues to just be problematic in the sense that it's still overstuffed. It still contains things that, were you designing this from the ground up, you would not put into the telecast. But we understand why they can't get rid of any of these things, or why they think they can't. The other part of this is kind of hilarious to me, is that it's like so sacred to, you know, we have to honor all these aspects of the Academy. So we have to have, you know, best animated short, best documentary short. Like, okay, I get it, but you can do that somewhere else. You can, again, have an online portion. If you were designing this for maximum watchability, you wouldn't do half the things that they do. So I thought the telecast was okay. I thought the producers did a great job of keeping it fairly brisk. It was still 3.5 hours long, but it didn't feel long to me, even as there were some strange choices made in how they did what they did. Let's talk about the winners and the losers. I saw one review that said, it was a comparison of previous Best Picture box office compared to this year. And, you know, the subtext or the text of that was basically that there was a period for 4 or 5 years where Best Pictures were films that people really didn't go see. And that one way to interpret this Oppenheimer near sweep is a re-embracing of the reality of where the movie business is and where it's going, which is did Oppenheimer win most of these awards because it was the best film? Or is some portion of that an affirmation that what's important is heady quality artistic films that also make $1 billion? Now, to go to Oscar winner Cord Jefferson's point, as he accepted his Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay, he used that time to implore, quote unquote, Hollywood to not make another $200 million movie, but to make, what did he say? To make $54 million movies or $10, $20 million movies, you know, embrace the middle. I appreciate the sentiment. I don't think that's going to be something that's going to happen because the business is just reliant on the bigger swing. And I think that these films that are in that range, many of which were nominated for Academy Awards last night, many of which won Academy Awards last night, Zone of Interest, Key among them, those are going to get made, but they're going to just have to get made differently. So in one sense, you know, Oppenheimer, which I thought was good. I wasn't blown away. I thought it was too long, but I appreciate Christopher Nolan and I'm glad he is working at the top of his game and achieving the results that he's achieving, because that means he will get to continue to make the types of films that interest him. And they're always worthy. However, I remain unresolved as to sort of the reasons why that film won so many things, whereas Killers of the Flower Moon, you know, basically won nothing. I mean, not even basically, won none of the Oscars that it was nominated for. There's an article in Variety that said, remarkably, Killers of the Flower Moon is Martin Scorsese's third film to go 0 for 10 nominations at the Oscars. The other two are Gangs of New York and The Irishman. Billie Eilish has more Oscars than Marty Scorsese. So it's just ridiculous. You know, whatever the issue is, and I don't know what it is, I don't know if, well, I would say that in terms of The Irishman and Killers of the Flower Moon, those are perhaps Netflix issues in the sense that Christopher Nolan's film is a studio film. It's released in the theaters. Netflix, which did Irishman and Killers of the Flower Moon, had limited releases, but it's still probably being viewed as both, I don't want to say an interloper, because the money is where filmmakers will go. Case in point, Bradley Cooper making Maestro. Yeah, the project is a Netflix project. So, you know, if you look at what occurred last night between Killers of the Flower Moon, and I mean, I hesitate to put Maestro in this category because it's nowhere near the quality of work that Killers of the Flower Moon is. But Cooper also was blanked out across the board on Maestro. And so I wonder if we're in still a moment where there's a bit of an us versus them, and where a film like Killers of the Flower Moon, which to me is just absolutely one of the very best films made in 2023, gets 0 Oscars. It's ludicrous. Something else has to be going on. And whether that's in, you know, other New York centric focused filmmakers, quote unquote, have sometimes been seen not to play the game in Hollywood, so they're not rewarded. I don't know if that's an issue. But I mean, the idea that Billie Eilish has more Oscars than Martin Scorsese is just an indication of how ludicrous the whole thing really is. However, if we're going to do it, I don't think it's too much to ask that we reward, at least most of the time, some of the things that would feel obvious, I think, to any general fan of going to the movies. Anyone who watched Killers of the Flower Moon, I don't want to say somewhat alone in this, but I mean, compared to Oppenheimer, compared to these other Best Picture nominees, the idea that it's not, you know, one of the three best films that were released last year is ludicrous. In fact, if I was ranking the best, the pictures that were nominated for Best Picture, you know, my top three would be Killers of the Flower Moon, number one, Zone of Interest, number two, probably Holdovers at three, and then I would put Oppenheimer at four. It's hard to say, but certainly my one, two, the two best films of the nominated ones were Killers of the Flower Moon and The Zone of Interest. Both incredible works of art, which advance the craft of filmmaking, and both of which tackle important socio-political realities, historical realities, and make them incredibly relevant to the time we're living in. So if Hollywood wants to wreathe itself in the glory of political activism and wearing buttons and slogans and campaigning for causes that are so vastly complex that it's almost impossible to reduce them to one side or the other sloganeering, well, these are the two films you should be rewarding. Now, I guess you would say Oppenheimer does the same thing. I don't know. I just found those two films, Killers and Zone of Interest, to be so vastly superior that it's crazy to me. If I was doing my should have been Oscars, who should have won? Well, again, I can't limit myself to just the nominated performances because, again, ridiculously, Leonardo DiCaprio was not nominated for Best Actor for Killers of the Flower Moon, that's ludicrous. That's ridiculous to me. His performance is absolutely one of the great film performances of the year, as was De Niro's. I mean, I think we all like Robert Downey Jr. We all like the idea of Robert Downey Jr. returning to actual films and actual acting after this long period of Marvel garbage. However, that performance in Oppenheimer is not as good as De Niro's career best performance in Killers of the Flower Moon. I mean, in pure acting appreciation, what De Niro is doing is technically and emotionally superior to what Downey Jr. does in Oppenheimer. So there's this sense of this kind of collective Downey Jr. victory lap. If you listen to all of his awards show speeches, which he's very entertaining and he makes us laugh, again, this part of this thing that I like about movie stars is we're invested in his story, but the part of his story that's being highlighted is probably almost 25, almost 30 years ago at this point. You know, the time when he's falling apart and in jail, that's so far in the past. Yet that's part of the speeches. It's part of the jokes that are made. It's part of what we're supposedly celebrating when we celebrate this victory. But it's not as if he got out of rehab 2 years ago. So I'm all for the guy putting his life back together. But it's a little funny to me that that's kind of the story. And as opposed to the real story is the guy made hundreds of millions of dollars making Marvel movies for 20 years and more power to him. It's a hard life as an actor, as any actor. So go grab the brass ring, bank the bucks, But the idea that it's somehow brave to take on this role, or that, as he said in his speech, I needed this role more than the role needed me. What he's saying is he needed to restart his acting career. His acting career, which he put on hold by banking hundreds of millions of dollars in various Marvel franchises. Well, cry for me, Argentina, but I don't happen to buy that as a reason to elevate that performance over what De Niro did in Killers of the Flower Moon, let alone Lily Gladstone. And I know that there's been, you know, I guess Emma Stone won this and Lily Gladstone won that. But again, Emma Stone now has two Academy Award for La La Land and what's the movie called? Pretty Things? I haven't seen it, to be fair. I do like Yorgos. So, you know, again, I'm glad that he's making films. Sorry, Poor Things, not Pretty Things. I'm glad that he's making films. I loved, what's the one he had with Colin Farrell? Jeez, what the hell is that called? Not Maestro. Don't want Maestro. Emma Stone, The Lobster. I thought The Lobster was hilarious. Loved it. So, I mean, I'm glad that he's there and making films, but the awards that it won over Killers of the Flower Moon is crazy to me. Production design? Are you joking? Again, all the clips that I saw that they showed of the film last night, it looked like CGI to me. It didn't look like practical sets. And we know from studying Killers of the Flower Moon and Jack Fisk's production design that these locations, these proppings, these costume design, all of this stuff represents so much effort, so much work, and frankly, a hell of a lot of work by Native American artisans who helped make the film what it was. So again, for Hollywood, like, wants to applaud itself and appreciate itself for appreciating this wide world of creative talent. Well, here it is right in front of you, but you don't reward it. It's kind of like, I thought Jimmy Kimmel had a great point to joke at the beginning when he said, you know, a lot of people felt Greta Gerwig should have been nominated for Best Director for Barbie. But wait, why are you applauding? You're the ones who didn't nominate her. You didn't vote for her. That was great. But in the same time, I cannot understand how you do not reward Killers of the Flower Moon with production design. It's insane, let alone costume design from Jacqueline West and her team of people who put so much effort into, yes, I'm going to use the word, the verisimilitude of the costumes on screen. So, I mean, production designs, costume, Thelma Schoonmaker for editing, Rodrigo Prieto for cinematography, best score, are you joking? You don't award Robbie Robertson a posthumous Oscar for his Killers of the Flower Moon score? I love Ludwig Göransson, who won his second Academy Award for Oppenheimer. I think he's an incredible composer. I love his music. I think he seems like an incredibly decent and kind and interesting person. So this is not one v the other, but I mean, of those two scores, I'm sorry, but the Robbie Robertson score and the music, the Native music, it's something people are going to listen to. Like, you're not putting on the Oppenheimer score for what, your nuclear Sunday morning coffee? I mean, so I'm going to sound like a Killers of the Flower Moon honk here when I say Leonardo DiCaprio, best actor, Lily Gladstone, best actress, De Niro, best supporting actor, best picture, best score, best cinematography, best editing, best costumes, best production design, and yes, best director. All of those. So if I list all of those, the only category I would say that they got right was Divine Joy Randolph getting Best Supporting Actress for The Holdovers. They got that one right. But the ignoring of all of these other categories, to me, is crazy. And it's enough to sort of say, you know what? Why do I even bother watching this shit? It's just ridiculous. And again, I'm a big Killers of the Flower Moon fan. I saw the film, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 times in the theater. I guess a lot of people didn't see it. Again, perhaps it's the Netflix streaming thing. You know, people had to make an effort to go see it. Maybe people felt, oh God, I'm going to be lectured. I don't know. But God, hard to believe. Now, another interesting aspect of the telecast, I thought, and the run-up, is I don't really pay too much attention to the awards season and the campaigning. But I do think it's funny that you can want it too much. And I think that with Bradley Cooper and Maestro is representative in the Netflix era of perhaps what contributes a bit to a backlash, where this is not a film that anyone particularly loves. I mean, I'm sure there are people out there who love the film, but as a $200 million film or whatever it is, it doesn't quite cross the bridge to relevance, because for Bradley, who's producing, writing, directing, acting in, it's a lot of hats, okay? And again, there's a great article by Kate Arthur and Daniel Daddario in Variety, who I thought hit this quite well. So I'm going to quote them. They said, "Alas, Bradley Cooper, the maestro who made Maestro is now 0-for-12 across his career Oscar nominations. He still doesn't have a directing nomination for either 2018's A Star is Born or for Maestro. And he personally lost all 3 of his nominations for acting in, writing, and producing Maestro. It's a sad coda for a film that began the season as Netflix's show pony, playing highly touted runs at the Venice and New York film festivals. And after doing a limited amount of painfully halting press for A Star is Born, Cooper was everywhere banging the drum for his Leonard Bernstein biopic, all with a smile on his face and a story to tell about the 6 years he spent learning to conduct," end quote. So again, I think there may be some sense within the industry that never really gets articulated by other directors. Let's remember that people within these classes and categories vote for these nominations. So is there some jealousy and side eye as directors look at a list of nominated films and think, Jesus, Netflix gave this guy $200 million to produce, write, act in, and direct this vanity project, which is really what it is. And you know what? I'm not rewarding that. Either because I'd like to get that myself or because I don't like the whole business of it. Because it isn't a business. You're losing money. And not only are you losing money, you're making it harder for the rest of us when you greenlight vanity projects like this that don't produce. They don't produce the results. They don't make the money and they don't garner the awards. And let me tell you, 9 times out of 9, any studio would rather have the money than the awards. So I have to think, given Killers of the Flower Moon and the budget there, I have to think that Maestro and the budget there and Netflix being involved with both, it has to be playing a part as this thing plays itself out, as theatrical productions play itself. So I think if you look at it dispassionately, and I'm not really doing that, but if you look at it dispassionately, and you have a film, a purely theatrical film like Oppenheimer, not only purely theatrical, but shot on IMAX. So it's theatrical in a number of different ways. It's like Dune 2, which is out now, similar to Christopher Nolan. And by the way, I did like that the cinematographer of Oppenheimer that won suggested that budding cinematographers out there, try shooting on celluloid. You'll find it's cheaper and it's a great medium. I appreciate that. I love that. But you have to think that when rewarding something, people are saying, I'm going to reward the thing that is pure cinema coming from within the Hollywood studio system, even though I'd love to get that Netflix money for myself. But I'm a little bit pissed off. I'm a little bit less pissed off that Marty got that money because it's Marty, but I'm still not voting for that because that's not helping us. It's hurting us. Have to wonder if that's the case. Now, I saw most of these films. I want to talk a little bit just about the ones I did see. I saw Killers of the Flower Moon many times. I saw Maestro. I saw Oppenheimer. I saw Barbie. I saw The Zone of Interest. I saw The Holdovers. I saw American Fiction. I did not see Past Lives, Poor Things, or Anatomy of a Fall. Of those, I definitely will first see Anatomy of a Fall because I'm a big Sandra Hüller fan after seeing The Zone of Interest. I will see Poor Things because I'm a big Yorgos fan, as I said. Although Emma Stone winning for Best Actress, I don't know. You know, Emma Stone's an interesting person to look at in terms of her career because in a way, it's understandable that you get to a point in your career as an actor where maybe for the first time you have choice and you have choice with perhaps less economic disadvantage than making big studio choices if those things even exist. But if you look at Emma Stone's 2023, she chose to make some bold, innovative, out there things in Poor Things and in the limited series The Curse, which I watched. And I don't know if I've mentioned it here, but first of all, she's brilliant in that. It's a show that I really, really liked at times, but I never want to see it again. And watching it was an exercise in anxiety-producing discomfort. And I guess that's the point. That's the point of the cringe cinema that someone like Nathan Fielder and Benny Safdie, who are the creative principals, are interested in. And they accomplish that because it's really difficult to watch, even though it is in places really, really funny. And there are some great performances, but they didn't stick the landing. And ultimately, I would have to say it's unsatisfying, but she's great in it. And I'm sure she is great in Poor Things because she is a phenomenal actor. Don't get me wrong. But she's at this phase where she's making these kinds of choices. And it will be curious to see what her choices are going forward. I mean, again, not that there are maybe a lot of choices, like how many great roles are there these days in movies? If you look at these nominations, the biggest of the films, do they have the best roles for actors? Oppenheimer, Maestro, don't know. If you look at them as sort of what I would value in cinema, you know, again, the two most innovative films that I saw, yet still powerful uses of all the aspects of cinema, it's Killers of the Flower Moon and it's The Zone of Interest. And The Zone of Interest, man, I think I'm going to do a whole episode just on the sound design of The Zone of Interest. It won deservedly so. Johnny Byrne and his team, wow, what a phenomenal piece of work the audio design of The Zone of Interest is. It is difficult to even talk about what's genius about it, but it is absolutely one of the most important characters in that film. And it has a dual purpose. It's working on the psyches of the characters we're watching or not, pointedly. But it also works on our psyche as viewers. And it makes us complicit. It makes us have to tune it out. It's brilliant. And the movie starts with a 2-minute, 45-second overture, which I read Johnny Byrne say, I thought it was such a bold choice because it says to the viewer, use your ears here. And that's what my experience was. I started watching it, and it's this very long black screen as the title fades out. And then it's just a very long section of sound design and music to the point of disorientation. But what it's doing is it's telling you to listen. And indeed, as you listen, the genius of that film, and I don't use that term lightly, is revealed. So, yeah, newsflash. The Oscars don't always get it right, but I guess it means something to be nominated. I don't know. You know, we're past the Oscars, thank God. We can move on with our lives. I can move on with my life. You can move on with yours. Anyway, if you haven't seen some of these films, go check them out. Go support them. And we will catch you later this week with another episode of the Full Cast and Crew podcast. Thank you for listening to my Oscar rant.